Chapter 2. I Leave Alexandria. The thoroughbred wanderer's idiosyncrasy I presume to be a composition of what phrenologists call inhabitiveness and locality, equally and largely developed. After a long and toilsome march, weary of the way, he drops into the nearest place of rest to become the most domestic of men. For a while he smokes the pipe of permanence with an infinite zest. He delights in various siestas during the day, relishing with all deep sleep during the dark hours. He enjoys dining at a fixed dinner hour, and he wonders at the demoralization of the mind which cannot find means of excitement in chit-chat or small talk, in a novel or a newspaper. But soon the passive fit has passed away. Again, a paroxysm of ennui coming on by slow degrees. Viator loses appetite. He walks about his room all night. He yawns at conversations, and a book acts upon him as a narcotic. The man wants to wander, and he must do so, or he shall die. After about a month, most pleasantly spent at Alexandria, I perceived the approach of the enemy, and as nothing hampered my incomings and outgoings, I surrendered. The world was all before me, and there was pleasant excitement in plunging single-handed into its chilling depths. Before my departure, however, there was much to be done. The land of the pharaohs is becoming civilized and unpleasantly so. Nothing can be more uncomfortable than its present middle state, between barbarism and the reverse. The passport system, now dying out of Europe, has sprung up, or rather has revived, in Egypt with peculiar vigour. Its good effects claim for it our respect. Still, we cannot but lament its inconvenience. By we, I mean real Easterns. As strangers, even those whose beards have whitened in the land, know absolutely nothing of what unfortunate natives must endure, I'm tempted to subjoin a short sketch of my adventures in search of a passport at Alexandria. Through ignorance, which might have cost me dear but for friend Larking's weight with the local authorities, I'd neglected to provide myself with a passport in England, and it was not without difficulty, involving much unclean dressing and an unlimited expenditure of broken English, that I obtained from Her Britannic Majesty's consul at Alexandria a certificate declaring me to be an Indo-British subject named Abdallah, by profession a doctor, aged 30, and not distinguished, at least so the frequent blanks seem to denote, by any remarkable conformation of eyes, nose, or cheek. For this, I disbursed $1, and here let me record the indignation with which I did it, that mighty Britain, the mistress of the seas, the ruler of one-sixth of mankind, should charge 5 shillings to pay for the shadow of a protecting wing, that I cannot speak my modernized Kiwi Sumra Manus without putting my hand into my pocket, in order that these officers of the great queen may not take too ruinously from a revenue of 70 millions. Oh, the meanness of our magnificence, the littleness of our greatness! My new passport would not carry me without the Zabit or Police Magistrate's countersignature, said Her Britannic Majesty's consul. Next day I went to the Zabit, who referred me to the governor of Alexandria, at whose gate I had the honour of squatting at least 3 hours, till a more compassionate clerk vouchsafed the information that the proper place to apply to was the Foreign Office. Thus a second day was utterly lost. On the morning of the 3rd I started, as directed, for the palace which crowns the headland of clay. It is a huge and couthly shell of building, in parallelogramic form, containing all kinds of public offices in glorious confusion, looking with their glaring whitewashed faces upon a central court where a few leafless, wind-wrung trees seem struggling for the breath of life in an eternal atmosphere of clay dust and sun blaze. The first person I addressed was a kawas, or police officer, who, coiled comfortably up in a bit of shade, fitting his person like a robe, was in full enjoyment of the Asiatic cave. Having presented the consular certificate and briefly stated the nature of my business, I ventured to inquire what was the right course to pursue for a visa. They have little respect for dervishes, it appears, at Alexandria. "Don't know," growled the man of authority, without moving anything but the quantity of tongue absolutely necessary for articulation. Now, there are three ways of treating Asiatic officials. By bribe, by bullying, or by bothering them with a dogged perseverance into attending to you and your concerns. The latter is the peculiar province of the poor. Moreover, this time I resolved, for other reasons, to be patient. I repeated my question in almost the same words. "Roo, be off," was what I obtained for all reply. But this time the question went so far as to open his eyes. Still I stood twirling the paper in my hands and looking very humble and very persevering, till aloud, "Roo, ya kalb! Go, O dog!" converted into a responsive curse the little speech I was preparing about the brotherhood of al-Islam and the mutual duties obligatory on true believers. I then turned away slowly and fiercely, for the next thing might have been a cut with a kirbash, the cat-o'-nine-tails of Egypt. And by the hammer of Thor, British flesh and blood could never have stood that. After which satisfactory scene, for satisfactory it was in one sense, proving the complete fitness of the dervish's costume, I tried a dozen other promiscuous sources of information. Policemen, grooms, scribes, donkey boys, and idlers in general. At length, wearied of patience, I offered a soldier some pinches of tobacco and promised him an oriental sixpence if he would manage the business for me. The man was interested by the tobacco and the pence. He took my hand, and, inquiring the while, he went along, led me from place to place, till, mounting a grand staircase, I stood in the presence of the deputy to the governor. It was a little, whey-faced, black-bearded Turk, coiled up in the usual conglomerate posture upon a calico-covered divan at the end of a long, bare, large-windowed room. Without deigning even to nod the head, which hung over his shoulder with transcendent listlessness and affectation of pride, in answer to my salams and benedictions, he eyed me with wicked eyes and faintly ejaculated, "Who art thou?" Then, hearing that I was a dervish and doctor, he must be an Osmanli Voltairian, that little Turk, the official snorted a contemptuous snort. He condescendingly added, however, that the proper source to seek was tart, which, meaning simply below, conveyed to an utter stranger rather imperfect information from a topographical point of view. At length, however, my soldier guide found out that a room in the custom house bore the honourable appellation of Foreign Office. Accordingly, I went there, and after sitting at least a couple of hours at the bolted door in the noonday sun, was told, with a fury which made me think I'd sinned, that the officer in whose charge the department was had been presented with an olive branch in the morning, and consequently that business was not to be done that day. The angry-faced official communicated the intelligence to a large group of Anatolian, Karamanian, Bosnian and Rumelian Turks. Sturdy, undersized, broad-shouldered, bare-legged, splay-footed, horny-fisted, dark-browed, honest-looking mountaineers, who were lounging about with long pistols and yataghans stuck in their broad sashes, headgear composed of immense tarbooshes with proportionate turbans coiled round them, and bearing two or three suits of substantial clothes, even at this season of the year, upon their shoulders. Like myself, they'd waited some hours, but they were not so patient under disappointment. They bluntly told the angry official that he and his master were a pair of idlers, and the curses that rumbled and gurgled in their hairy throats as they strode towards the door sounded like the growling of wild beasts. Thus was another day truly orientally lost. On the morrow, however, I obtained permission, in the character of Dr. Abdullah, to visit any part of Egypt I pleased, and to retain possession of my dagger and pistols. And now I must explain what induced me to take so much trouble about a passport. The home reader naturally inquires, why not travel under your English name? For this reason. In the generality of barbarous countries, you must either proceed like Bruce, preserving the dignity of manhood and carrying matters with a high hand, or you must worm your way by timidity and subservience, in fact, by becoming an animal too contemptible for man to let or injure. But to pass through the Muslim's holy land, you must either be a born believer or have become one. In the former case, you may demean yourself as you please. In the latter, a path is ready prepared for you. My spirit couldn't bend to own myself a Burma, a renegade, to be pointed at and shunned and catechised, an object of suspicion to the many and of contempt to all. Moreover, it would have obstructed the aim of my wanderings. The convert is always watched with Argus eyes, and men do not willingly give information to a new Muslim, especially a Frank. They suspect his conversion to be feigned or forced, look upon him as a spy, and let him see as little of life as possible. Firmly as was my heart set upon travelling in Arabia, by heaven, I would have given up the dear project rather than purchase a doubtful and partial success at such a price. Consequently, I had no choice but to appear as a born believer. And part of my birthright in that respectable character was toil and trouble in obtaining a passport. Then I had to provide myself with certain necessaries for the way. These were not numerous. The silver-mounted dressing-bag is here supplied by a rag containing a toothstick, a bit of soap, and a comb, wooden, for both bone and tortoiseshell are not, religiously speaking, correct. Equally simple was my wardrobe, a change or two of clothing. It's a great mistake to carry too few clothes, and those who travel as Orientals should always have at least one very grand suit for use on critical occasions. Throughout the East, a badly dressed man is a pauper, and, as in England, a pauper, unless he belongs to an order having a right to be poor, is a scoundrel. The only article of canteen description was a zemzemaya, a goatskin water bag, which, especially when new, communicates to its contents a ferruginous aspect and a wholesome, though hardly an attractive, flavour of tanno gelatin. This was a necessary. To drink out of a tumbler, possibly fresh from pig-eating lips, would have entailed a certain loss of reputation. For bedding and furniture, I had a coarse Persian rug, which, besides being couch, acted as chair, table and oratory, a cotton-stuffed chintz-covered pillow, a blanket in case of cold, and a sheet which did duty for tent and mosquito curtains in nights of heat. As shade is a convenience not always procurable, another necessary was a huge cotton umbrella of Eastern make, brightly yellow, suggesting the idea of an overgrown marigold. I had also a substantial housewife, the gift of a kind relative, Miss Elizabeth Stisted, It was a roll of canvas, carefully soiled and garnished with needles and thread, cobbler's wax, buttons and other such articles. These things were most useful in lands where tailors abound not. Besides which, the sight of a man darning his coat or patching his slippers teems with pleasing ideas of humility. A dagger, a brass inkstand and penholder stuck in the belt, and a mighty rosary, which on occasion might have been converted into a weapon of offence, completed my equipment. I must not omit to mention the proper method of carrying money, which in these lands should never be entrusted to box or bag. A common cotton purse, secured in a breast pocket, for Egypt now abounds in that civilized animal, the pickpocket, contained silver pieces and small change. My gold, of which I carried 25 sovereigns, and papers, were committed to a substantial leathern belt of Maghrebi manufacture, made to be strapped round the waist under the dress. The great inconvenience of the belt is its weight, especially where dollars must be carried, as in Arabia, causing chafes and discomfort at night. Moreover, it can scarcely be called safe. In dangerous countries, weary travellers will adopt surer precautions. A pair of common native courgeen or saddlebags contained my wardrobe. The bed was readily rolled up into a bundle. And for a medicine chest, I bought a pea-green box with red and yellow flowers, capable of standing falls from a camel twice a day. The next step was to find out when the local steamer would start for Cairo. And accordingly I betook myself to the transit office. No vessel was advertised. I was directed to call every evening until satisfied. At last the fortunate event took place. A weekly departure, which, by the by, occurred once every fortnight or so, was in orders for the next day. I hurried to the office, but didn't reach it till past noon, the hour of idleness. A little dark gentleman, Mr. Green, so formed and dressed as exactly to resemble a liver and tan bull terrier, who, with his heels on the table, was dozing, cigar in mouth, over the last Galignani, positively refused, after a time, for at first he wouldn't speak at all, to let me take my passage till 3 in the afternoon. I inquired when the boat started, upon which he referred me, as I had spoken bad Italian, to the advertisement. I pleaded inability to read or write, whereupon he testily cried, alle nove, at nine. Still appearing uncertain, I drove him out of his chair when he rose with a curse and read 8 a.m. An unhappy Eastern, depending upon what he said, would have been precisely 1 hour too late. Thus we were lapsing into the real good old East Indian style of doing business. Thus Anglo Indicus orders his first clerk to execute some commission. The senior, having work upon his hands, sends a junior. The junior finds the sun hot and passes on the word to a peon. The peon charges a porter with the errand, and the porter quietly sits or dozes in his place, trusting that fate will bring him out of the scrape, but firmly resolved, though the shattered globe fall, not to stir an inch. At length, about the end of May 1853, all was ready. Not without a feeling of regret, I left my little room among the white myrtle blossoms and the rosy oleander flowers with the almond smell. I kissed with humble ostentation my good host's hands in presence of his servant. He had become somewhat unpleasantly anxious of late to induce in me the true Oriental feeling by a slight administration of the bastinado. I bade adieu to my patients, who now amounted to about 50, shaking hands with all meekly and with religious equality of attention, and mounted in a trap, which looked like a cross between a wheelbarrow and a dog-cart, drawn by a kicking, jibbing and biting mule, I set out for the steamer, the Little Asthmatic.